Europe since the war. The story of 10 years of European cooperation.
What is the plight to which Europe has been reduced? Some of the smaller states have indeed made a good recovery. But over wide areas, a vast quivering mass of tormented, hungry, careworn and bewildered human beings gape at the ruins of their cities and their homes and scan the dark horizons for the approach of some new peril, tyranny or terror. Among the victors, there is a babel of voices. Among the vanquished, the sullen silence of despair.
Well, I'm sure that you recognize that voice. Yes, it's Winston Churchill, speaking at Zurich in Switzerland in 1946, just after the war. And after describing the desperate state to which Europe had brought itself, Churchill added that there was a way out, a way by which Europe could be restored to health.
What is this sovereign remedy? It is to recreate the European family, or as much of it as we can, and to provide it with a structure under which it can dwell in peace, in safety, and in freedom. We must build a kind of United States of Europe. In this way only will hundreds of millions of toilers be able to regain the simple joys and hopes which make life worth living.
To tell you the story of how and how far Europe has succeeded in uniting, and with what results, is Lord Boothby.
Europe after the war was a sorry sight. In most countries, the war had caused vast material damage which was still unrepaired. Even those countries that had escaped bombing, invasion, or occupation had had their industries dislocated, their trade with other countries ruined, their traditional sources of supply cut off. To restore Europe to its peacetime prosperity was obviously going to be a long and difficult job. Then the United States made an offer since described as the most unsordid act in history. During and after the war, the United States had given considerable help to its individual European allies. Now there was a change of policy. America was still ready to help, and on a greater scale than ever before. But its assistance would go to Europe as a whole, and Europe must also help herself. The European countries must themselves agree how best to use the resources to be made available to them. The American Secretary of State, the late General George Marshall, put it in these words.
It is already evident that before the United States government can proceed much further in its efforts to alleviate the situation and help start the European world on its way to recovery, there must be some agreement among the countries of Europe as to the requirements of the situation and the part those countries themselves will take in order to give a proper effect to whatever action might be undertaken by this government. It would be neither fitting nor efficacious for our government to undertake to draw up unilaterally a program designed to place Europe on its feet economically. This is the business of the Europeans. The initiative, I think, must come from Europe. The role of this country should consist of friendly aid in the drafting of a European program and of later support of such a program, so far as it may be practical for us to do so. The program should be a joint, agreed to by a number, if not all, European nations.
Talks on this offer began.
Back in 1492 or 93, or maybe it was 94, it really doesn't affect it. A funny little Portuguese, or did he come from Italy? My history, I regret, is much neglected. decided to leave his home and wander across the foam. So we've got to thank Columbus for lots of little things that happen in the world today. For he got the notion to travel across the ocean and ferret out the USA. Yes, we've got to thank Columbus for lots of little things we've learned to love and hold so dear. That cute nasal twang which enhances the English language and makes it such a joy to hear. How strange, it's quite a mystery, that fate with one decisive stroke should change the course of history from old and mild to rum and coke. Yes, we've got to thank Columbus for guys who put us wise to everything from A to Z, who taught us to holler, there's only one God, the dollar, let's worship it on bended knee. We've got to thank Columbus for thousands of GIs who never seem to give a damn. Get our teenagers plastered and leave them a little bastard, a souvenir of Uncle Sam. That old back-slapping bonhomie, the daintiness of dames in jeans, that subtle new gastronomy, like bubblegum and pork and beans. So anyone who comes from the good old USA will find a welcome on the mat. We can't do without 'em, whatever we say about 'em, and we've got to thank Columbus for that.
How far are you going to?
Washington.
We'll get off in Washington. We'll hook a ride.
Where are you going?
Alaska.
Alaska? What are you on, vacation?
She wants to live there because it's cleaner.
Cleaner? Cleaner than what?
You don't have to tell everybody about it. Pretty soon they'll all go there and it won't be so clean.
What makes you think it's cleaner?
I saw a picture of it. Alaska's very clean. It appeared to look very white to me. Don't you think?
Yep, that was before the big thaw.
Before the what?
And refused to concede that the organization responsible for distributing the aid should have any say in how it was used. So, when a little later the European countries were invited to a conference to draw up together a balance sheet of Europe's resources and needs, only one communist country accepted, and she was later obliged by Russia to withdraw. The Iron Curtain had shut down on economic cooperation. The 16 countries that did respond to the invitation managed to agree in a remarkably short time, not only on the division of the aid for which they were going to ask the United States, but also on something even more important: to set up an organization in which each country would work together in economic matters with its neighbors. Interest, this new body was called the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, OEEC, and its headquarters were set up in Paris.
Here is the late Ernest Bevin, then British Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, in a speech recorded by the BBC in July 1948.
Mr. Ambassador, sir, the signature of this agreement formally brings into operation the European Recovery Program for the United Kingdom. Similar agreements are going into force with the other participating countries. These agreements mark the fulfillment of an outstanding feat of constructive statesmanship. I remember well the deep feeling which I heard over the wireless Mr. Marshall's great speech at Harvard a year ago last June. It was a speech from one continent to another, saying, in fact, get together, put up your plan, and we will try to carry it out. And it was one which few, in the light of the European situation, could resist. I believe that we and our friends who now make up the Organization of the European Economic Cooperation have played our part well. In the short time, and a year in matters of this kind is a short time, we and the other participating countries have worked together in a great cooperative effort. Now, our task is defined. Our mutual undertakings have been settled, and we can go forward to achieve that economic stability in Europe which alone can make enduring peace possible.
Oh, easy.
People of a small
La hembra, el hombre, la mujer, el muchacho.
Here's a song called An Awful Lot of Bull, a title which aptly describes
la
the pseudo-Spanish
muchacha.
Twaddle that follows. Fernando, Hernando, Charlie Lopez was a very famous toreador. But Fernando, Hernando, up Sunday says, I ain't a fightin' bulls anymore. He added, I've had it, take me away. In other words, my belly, it is full. I go in the bull ring three times a day, and that's an awful lot of bull. They've gored me, they've grilled me, they've damn nearly killed me, they've left me as weak as a kitten. They've grabbed me and jabbed me, they've turned round and stabbed me and ruined the spot that I sit in. So Fernando, Hernando, Charlie Lopez got himself an agent with some pull. Now in some dingy hole he plays rock and roll, and that's an awful lot of bull. Oh, Fernando, Hernando, Charlie Lopez now pursues a different kind of life. He's got seven kids and proudly he says, soon I'm going to get me a wife. The sight of a bull ring makes him feel sick, reminding him of all the things he did. And one thing that really gets on his wick is any mention of Madrid, where they spiked him, chi-hiked him, and plainly disliked him, ignoring the way he was feeling. They pitched him and tossed him and crisped him and crossed him and scattered him over the ceiling. Now Fernando, Hernando, Charlie Lopez rides around the village on a mule. The best toreador in Spain, so he says, and that's an awful lot of bull.
El pulgar, la uña,
thank you.
speaking in August 1950.
Meine verehrten Kollegen, durch Ihre Einladung an uns haben Sie uns Deutschen eine Möglichkeit gegeben, uns selbst wiederzufinden und uns aus der Wüste und der Zerstörung, in die wir durch eine verbrecherische Tyrannei verbannt waren, wieder herauszukommen. Wir Deutsche, meine Damen und Herren, fühlen uns genauso wenig wie Sie dort heimisch, wo Freiheit und Gerechtigkeit unterdrückt werden. Wir fühlen uns heimisch hier, innerhalb der Gemeinschaft der freien Nationen. Wir möchten für alle Zeiten zu den Völkern gehören, denen die Freiheit und die Gerechtigkeit wichtiger sind als ihr Leben.
The statute of the Council seemed to follow closely what the Hague Congress had demanded. It set up a European Consultative Assembly so that for the first time members of Parliament were called upon to take part in what can be termed parliamentary diplomacy. Respect for human rights was made a condition of membership. Clearly, the Council of Europe was something new, something which aroused great interest and enormous hopes. But in fact, the Council wasn't altogether what it seemed. It was a compromise between those who wanted a federation like the United States of America and those who feared to go beyond intergovernmental cooperation. The Council had its parliamentary assembly, but its only powers were those of recommendation. And the members of the executive body of the Council, a committee of foreign ministers, were each armed with the right of veto. In this situation, the British attitude was all important. Of course, Franco-German reconciliation was also vital, but there were, even then, many signs that this reconciliation was well underway. The choice of Strasbourg as the Council's seat was only one of them. The unknown and the crucial factor was this: what would be Britain's attitude towards a continent seeking its unity? Unhappily, it soon became apparent that it was to be one of extreme prudence, hedged around with innumerable reservations. Let us listen to some of these early debates in the Consultative Assembly. The first question which arose was that of the nature of the union to be reached with the members of the Council. The Assembly had on its agenda the following item: consideration of any necessary changes in the political structure of Europe to achieve greater unity.
On the 16th of August, 1949, Monsieur André Philippe stated,
Si nous voulons créer l'Europe, si nous voulons unifier en un marché commun, cette Europe qui ne peut vivre qu'unie, sous peine de connaître la catastrophe et les crises les plus graves dans un délai plus bref que certains le font.
Sanitary bits of hide. We need the facts, honestly sought for, and impartially set out. The peoples of Europe need the facts. When we have them, let the argument proceed. And I, for one, am prepared to reserve my final judgment until then.
The Scandinavians shared the British reluctance to envisage federal solutions. Thus, Mr. Finn Mo, a prominent Norwegian representative, said,
"The reason for this, let us call it negative attitude, on the part of Great Britain and the Scandinavian countries towards a federal approach, is not any dislike of the federal principle or any opposition to European cooperation. The reason is to be found in geographical and political realities, geographic and political facts, which cannot be changed by any appeals, and still less by any attacks."
In the face of this opposition between the British and continental approaches, Mr. de Valera outlined the compromise solution, which was later destined to be given a practical trial.
"If the nations here on the mainland of the continent consider that they cannot wait for us, perhaps they should consider going on without us by an agreement amongst themselves for a closer union. It is with no desire to delay progress towards a union that some of us have spoken against the attempt at immediate federation."
The debate ended with a resolution of great significance for the future, by which the Assembly declared,
"The aim and goal of the Council of Europe is the creation of a European political authority with limited functions but real powers."
The 15 foreign ministers endorsed the compromise idea of an advance towards federation by only some of the member states, which had first been put forward by Mr. de Valera and subsequently approved by the Consultative Assembly as a whole. In November 1950, Count Carlo Sforza, as chairman of the Committee of Ministers, announced the minister's decision to the Assembly in the following terms.
"Sera dorénavant possible au Conseil de l'Europe de constituer dans son sein des ententes restreintes, des accords partiels, des autorités spécialisées, sans pour cela amoindrir ou affaiblir le cadre général de la collaboration européenne tel qu'il est conçu par le statut, ce qui affirme que nous tous nous sommes nécessaires à nous tous."
Partial agreements.
In
specialized authority. An authority with limited functions but real power. What did this mean in practice? Europe had not long to wait. Monsieur Robert Schuman, Foreign Minister of France, proposed that the entire Franco-German production of coal and steel be placed under a single joint high authority within an organization open to all Council of Europe and OEEC countries.
This is what Monsieur Robert Schuman himself said about his proposal on the 10th of August 1950 when introducing it in the Consultative Assembly.
"La proposition qui a été faite acceptée. Si elle devient réalité telle qu'elle a été faite et acceptée, implique des mutualités que nous ne pouvons pas encore pleinement mesurer, mais qui se développeront rapidement dans le sens d'une unification complète économique et politique de l'Europe."
The Schuman plan seemed closely in line with the functional method favored by the British and Scandinavians. But it was limited to one clearly defined sector, coal and steel. The plan required, however, that a considerable part of national powers of control over these industries should be handed over to a European authority. As a result, when it came to the point, Britain, Ireland, and the Scandinavian countries refused to take part in the negotiations. There were left Germany, Italy, and the three Benelux. Inside a Europe already divided by the Iron Curtain, a second split began. Not everyone suspected it was a split. Indeed, the Consultative Assembly passed a resolution by a massive majority approving the Schuman Plan as perhaps the most important contribution to European unity today. Others, however, had their doubts, particularly when they reflected that Great Britain was taking no part in this new country.
For example, Mr. Howard McMillan, speaking in Strasbourg, expressed these views.
Despite, therefore, of much that has been done, the result has some important and perhaps dangerous aspects. For the conclusion of the great European agreement dealing with the broad direction of those basic industries of Europe, which are of vital importance to the future of Europe, both for the purposes of progress in peace and of defense in war. Of Great Britain is to say the least. It is for us somehow to make sure that it does not prove disastrous.
Mr. Macmillan's regrets and forebodings were justified. Six countries had set out in a direction which would take them progressively further away from the others. And a fundamental development in European unity was taking place outside the body which had inspired it, the Council of Europe. Nonetheless, in those halcyon days, it seemed that Mr. Macmillan, then in the opposition, was being unnecessarily pessimistic. The movement towards the Union of Europe had already several successes to its credit. And did not Strasbourg remain its unquestioned center? The first application of the Assembly's proposals followed indeed not long after. In July 1950, OEEC set up the European Payments Union to remove the payments difficulties which confined European trade to the shackles of bilateral barter by establishing a genuinely multilateral payment system financed by automatic long-term credit. In the economic field, it was the role of the Council to throw out ideas which were put into practice by more specialized groups. In the field of human rights, it acted in
the banners of futures assemble in the sun, and you'll be there beside me on the march. Then you'll see the banners and the singing. The flame, stand up and fight. Our hearts are all aflame. The new life is coming to put the past to shame. Your happiness is part of the sunlight. A thousand cries will rise into a clamor. Its unity is strong. From north and south, they come to join the throng. From nitrate fields, amid us streaming in, streaming in. From the forests in the south, they are together now. Their struggle has the shape of things to come, and
us, Terra Vencida.
The people united will never be defeated.
Nous voyons les choses de manière tout à fait différente. Et s'il n'y avait pas quelque chose peut-être d'un peu prétentieux à dire ceci, je vous dirais, notre perspective historique à l'heure actuelle n'est pas semblable.
Mrs. Spark resigned when the Consultative Assembly was at the height of its prestige and influence. By the end of 1951, it had in fact established itself as the European Forum, as was proved by the acceptance of the United States Congress of an invitation to send a delegation to Strasbourg for 5 days of public debate on European and Atlantic problems. These discussions, in which I took part, between an American team of 7 senators and 7 members of the House of Representatives and a slightly larger delegation of European members of Parliament, were lively and successful. A little later, the Consultative Assembly, until that time the only international parliamentary assembly in the world, was joined by a second parliamentary body. The establishment of the coal and steel community brought into being another European assembly to which only the 6 sent representatives. There was a further difference. This new assembly had powers. Moreover, at its very first meeting, this new assembly was to be entrusted with an unexpectedly big and exciting task. Dr. Adenauer, West German Chancellor, asked it in the name of the 6 governments to draw up a treaty establishing yet another community, one that would go the European political community.
Sie sind in erster Linie berufen, innerhalb des Ihnen im Vertrage über die Montangemeinschaft bezogenen Rahmen tätig zu werden. Aber im Vertrauen auf die in Ihnen vorhandene Dynamik hat der Rat der Minister geglaubt, Sie bitten zu sollen, über das, was im Vertrage vorgesehen ist, hinaus eine weitere Aufgabe von sehr großer Bedeutung zu übernehmen, um so die politische Entwicklung Europas zu beschleunigen. Im Geiste der Grundsätze des Artikels 38 des Vertrages über die Gründung der Europäischen Verteidigungsgemeinschaft und unbeschadeter Bestimmungen dieses Vertrages werden die Mitglieder der Versammlung der Montangesellschaft gebeten, den Entwurf eines Vertrages über die Gründung einer europäischen politischen Gemeinschaft auszuarbeiten.
In March 1953, the 6 ministers duly received from the Assembly the draft treaty they had asked for. It looked as though the 6 had decided to take the plunge towards a true federation of their country. And then, nothing happened. For though 5 of the 6 countries' parliaments had approved the European Defence Community, one of them had not, France. And until France had approved the European Defence Community, no further progress was possible than the public and
the
people. In August 1954, the French Parliament at last
agreed.
The decision was negative. France rejected the European Defence Community.
Yes.
In the Europe of the 6, there was widespread dismay and a sense of crisis. At this point, the House of Europe in Strasbourg became the refuge to which they returned for temporary shelter.
Mr. Bayet, then Foreign Minister of the Netherlands, had this to say.
But I think we all think the Council of Europe is like the home where we come back to and where we try to settle those differences of approach which ask for coordination.
And at this moment, for once, Britain took the lead. Mr. Eden started on his tour of European capitals and secured an agreement for a new defense organization, the Western European Union, and for Germany's rearmament and entry into NATO. The next phase opened at Messina in Sicily in the summer of 1954. There, the ministers of the Six decided on a new approach, to try to unify their countries economically in the expectation that this would lead to political disarray. Monsieur Spark, speaking as Belgian foreign minister, reported to the consultative assembly on the Messina meeting in these words.
L'idée générale était celle-ci. L'heure de l'Europe politique n'a pas l'échec que nous venons de subir en ce qui concerne...
The failure of the European Defence Community, says Mr. Spark, proved that it was premature to try to unite Europe by the direct constitutional approach. Other methods of reaching this ultimate goal of an integrated Europe must be tried. If no progress could be made on the political front, then the more indirect approach, via functional methods of cooperation, must be attempted. At Messina, the ministers had agreed to push for the general economic integration of the Six, taking advantage of the experiment already embarked upon successfully in the coal and steel community.
Dans le domaine de la communauté européenne du charbon et de l'acier.
In the consultative assembly, reactions to the idea were mainly enthusiastic. The governments not immediately concerned were more skeptical. The British government certainly didn't seem to think that this ambitious plan to build a European common market had much future, since for a long while they did nothing about it. But as the six-bar negotiations proceeded, there came a change. Suddenly it dawned on the other European governments that if the Six succeeded in setting up a single economic unit, pursuing common policy, having nearly as many people as the United States, and within which goods and men and capital could circulate freely, this might cause hardship to those left outside. What about their own exports? And to begin with, the British thought that all was going well. Thus, in autumn 1957, Mr. Reginald Maudling, who had been chairman of the OEEC committee working in the free trade area, could indicate substantial progress.
The Council declares its determination to secure the establishment of a European free trade area. That goes much further and is far more definite than anything previously said by the Council of the OEEC. And I would particularly emphasize once again the words determination to secure the establishment of a European free trade area, because it was to that that all the 17 countries present at the Paris meeting unanimously subscribed.
Meanwhile, the Six had signed in Rome two treaties setting up respectively a European Atomic Community, Euratom, and a General Economic Community, the Common Market. Monsieur Jean Rey, then Belgian Minister for Economic Affairs and now a member of the Common Market Executive, was convinced that the creation of the Common Market would help forward rather than hinder the establishment of a wider European trading association.
Je voudrais tout d'abord dire qu'il me semble que tout le monde a intérêt à la conclusion et non pas à l'échec de la négociation sur la zone de libre-échange. Il me paraît frappant que les six y aient intérêt, et ce n'est pas une formule vaine qu'ils ont mis dans le préambule du traité de Rome lorsqu'ils ont affirmé leur volonté de faire en sorte que leur effort soit un effort d'intégration auquel ils invitent les autres États à s'associer.
Alas for these hopes. 1958, when OEEC celebrated its 10th anniversary, saw the entry into force of the common market, which was very soon to prove its value in increasing the prosperity of the six countries and vastly expanding trade between them. But 1958 was to end with the complete breakdown of the free trade area negotiations conducted under the auspices of OEEC. It was to see also a serious deterioration in the relations between Britain and France, and the opening of a crack in Europe, which jeopardizes nearly all that has been achieved in 10 years of cooperation. For that crack is not yet repaired. And who can tell how long it will take before it is repaired, or how it can be done? It is an ironical fact that it was also in 1958 that the extent of what the European countries had achieved by working together, of the fantastic progress made by Europe in the economic field initiated by the Marshall Plan, became clear to the whole world. For example, the convertibility of European currencies was at last achieved.
Here is Ludwig Erhard, German Vice Chancellor and Minister for Economic Affairs, addressing the Consultative Assembly in April 1959.
Ein wirklich geschichtliches Ereignis aber hat die Verbindung unter den europäischen Nationen besonders klar unter Beweis gestellt. Das war eben die Einführung der Konvertierbarkeit Ende 1958. Dieses Ereignis bedeutet die Krönung einer langen und mühsamen Arbeit im Streben nach einer völligen Befreiung des internationalen Handels- und Zahlungsverkehrs von künstlichen Beschränkungen. Die Konvertierbarkeit bedeutet darüber hinaus die völlige und in gewisser Weise unwiderrufliche Integration der europäischen Wirtschaft in weiteren Rahmen der Welt.
Yeah.
is what the late John Edwards, the only Englishman to be elected
to my mind, we must say, as the Council of Europe, that we want economic unity in Europe for all Europe. Let me make myself clear. I have myself said on numerous occasions that I believe in the European Economic Community and the six-power community in general. I'm sure that we owe them a great debt of gratitude for their leadership and for being in the successful vanguard of the European idea. But it cannot possibly be in the interests of the European people as a whole to have groups forming now in Northern Europe, in Central Europe, perhaps tomorrow in Southern Europe. And I think it's the duty of the Council of Europe to reaffirm this broad principle of European unity to all the member states which we want to see achieved.
This has been the story of 10 years' effort to unite Europe. It ends with a question mark. For although the Council of Europe has vigorously reaffirmed the broad principle of European Union, at the moment that principle remains seriously threatened. And we, who are in the middle of this story, cannot predict whether it will have a happy end. But this we can see. What has happened in Europe since the war is unprecedented. And on this account, not without problems. Back as our history goes, our countries have vied with each other, often with arms, often by means only slightly less deadly. Since 1948, they have, at any rate, although recently, been doing the opposite.
La Cocina.
Instead of fighting, they've become allies. Instead of picking each other's pockets, they've joined together in OEC to bring about a level of prosperity for all, never before attained by any. Europe, in fact, has made a new departure. Not, as yet it must be said, a completely successful one. I think that all of us who have been members of the Council of Europe would agree that, as well as being an exhilarating experience, it has also been a frustrating one. Something has been achieved. A good deal, in fact, certainly more than is realized. But I can't help thinking that less has been achieved than should have been. Less at all events than we thought and hoped and dreamed of at The Hague in 1948. Less, I think, than is needed if Europe is now to achieve real unity. The pity of it is that if the Council of Europe had been effective.